Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. I'm Sarah Bankson, Deputy Director of RTP. Today, we're happy to host two experts discussing the challenges of rebuilding in California in the wake of the Palisades fires. Jeremy Talcott is an attorney in the Pacific Legal Foundation's property rights practice. He also leads PLF's Coastal Land Rights Project. We're also joined by Donald Cochin, Professor of Law and Executive Director of the Law and Economics Center at George Mason University Scalia Law School. Thank you both for being with us today. Our listeners can read the full bios for both of our speakers at regproject.org. With that, I'll hand it over to you, Professor Cochin.
Thanks so much, Sarah, and thanks to the Regulatory Transparency Project for hosting this forum. I'm excited to sit down with Jeremy Talcott today to talk a little bit about the existing environment for regulations and land use and development in California and throughout the country, with a specific emphasis on what's happening today. It's important to regularly re-examine our regulatory frameworks for their effectiveness at meeting stated objectives. In other words, are they bringing the utility and benefits that they claim, as well as to assess the negative impacts of costs associated with the regulations, including the unintended consequence of otherwise well-meaning action. In other words, to help bring a little bit of focus and to help make more transparent that which is otherwise less clear. Sometimes critical inflection points bring heightened awareness to the effects of regulation. When that happens, careful examination is doubly important, including because major events can bring unlikely coalitions to the table to reevaluate existing structures and erroneous or outdated assumptions on where to set regulatory standards, as well as to see what's working. Such is the case today in California. California is always a regulatory playground worth observing, but it presents an especially useful case study in regulation in light of current events, including the Palisades fire and other natural catastrophes throughout the state that have shined a light on some of the effects of the existing regulatory environment. To better inform the debate, we have with us, as Sarah mentioned on this podcast, a leading expert with substantial experience dealing with land use regulations, property rights, natural resources, and related issues on the ground in California and across the United States. As mentioned, I'm delighted to sit down here with Jeremy Talcott, who I'm going to turn it over to in just a moment. Jeremy's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation Property Rights Practice. He focuses on fundamental rights of landowners to use and develop their property. He also leads PLF's Coastal Land Rights Project. Jeremy obtained his undergraduate degree in communications from the University of Central Florida, and he graduated cum laude from Chapman University Fowler School of Law in Orange, California, where he was president of the Federalist Society and senior articles editor of the Chapman Law Review. Jeremy, I'm going to turn it over to you to kind of get us started, but I think that we're principally focused today on what's happening on the ground and opportunities for reform. But before we get there, we need to understand the current and pre-existing regulatory environment that has led us to the discussions we're having today. So can you describe a little bit about the regulatory environment for development in California, how CEQA and other regulatory structures have been working? What's the expense? How is it affecting timing on land development projects? You know, is it effective? Those sorts of things. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing on the ground.
Yes, thank you, Donald. Well, you know, the very short answer is that the regulatory framework in California is probably one of the most burdensome in the entire country, if not the most burdensome. And really, because of that, it is the state in the country that has had the highest growth in both new home prices and rent. Individuals in California spend far above the national average on all of their home costs, generally 2.5 times the national average. And again, that expense has risen far more than the rest of the country over the same period. And even California itself, the Legislative Analyst's Office, has recognized that the single largest driver of those costs are the regulatory framework of California. And in California, in addition to all of the local zoning and regulations, land use regulations that individuals must navigate to obtain a development permit. There's also several extensive environmental overlay programs that have made, again, California one of the most costly and time-consuming places to build. So as you've mentioned, there's CEQA, which is the California Environmental Quality Act, as well as the California Coastal Act. And while, that really only applies to the coastal zone of California, it's notable that the coastal zone covers over 60% of the individuals living in California. So unsurprisingly, the California coast is one of the most desirable places to live. It's where we've done a lot of development in the past, but these days it is far and away the most expensive place to attempt to build in California. And a huge part of that has to do with the California Coastal Commission, who, again, whatever their initial mission might have been, which really I think this was passed to try and preserve coastal resources, has really over the subsequent decades become something much larger and almost serves as kind of a super zoning board over all these local governments, and they have asserted huge amounts of appellate jurisdiction. So taking on more permit appeals than they might previously have been authorized to take, and then also have more finely scrutinized permits and attempted to meddle in the outcomes of those permits than I think the Coastal Act originally intended. So the reality is, it is very easy for individuals in California, if you have a development that they do not like, it is very easy for them to sue under either of these regulations. And the California courts have very zealously applied these environmental regulations in ways that often force individuals to go back time and again. Perhaps they succeed in one lawsuit, go back and fix shortcomings in an environmental impact report, and then get sued again for another shortcoming. And as mentioned, every time, time is money. Just the time cost alone can be substantial, but endless repeated environmental reports can add hundreds of thousands of dollars to any development project. And the reality is that this leaves development in the hands only of the largest development groups, often in California, and makes it very difficult and onerous on individuals to make productive use of their property.
Would it be fair to say that the California Coastal Commission is inserting itself into the process in ways that in and of itself, just that insertion is causing additional delays, and also that some of it is unnecessarily redundant upon existing regulatory approvals? As you mentioned, then it cycles through in multiple levels of litigation to add more and more delays. But it really is this intentional insertion of the CCC into far more minutia of decision making that makes it difficult to process?
That's correct. And I think it's very notable that when the Coastal Act was initially passed, there was a very strong incentive contained within the act for local governments to pass new regulation. These are called local coastal programs, or LCPs. And under the structure of the Coastal Act, initially, the Coastal Commission was given a tremendous amount of power over development in this coastal zone. And then the incentive for local governments was, if you pass an LCP and submit it to the commission, and the commission approves it as consistent with the Coastal Act, then we will return your primary permitting authority to you, the local government. And at that point, the commission retains appellate jurisdiction only, and under what I would say is the original conception of the act, that's a fairly limited authority. In other words, it's not there to oversee these minor development decisions. Rather, it's there to, if a local government fails to follow the terms of its local coastal program, the commission can step in and say, you're approving development that is inconsistent with the rules that we certified. And if you do that, we're going to overturn that development. And turning to the second part of your question on delays, the delays can be substantial. We've at PLF, we've recently done a report on this appellate process. And again, under some kind of interesting interpretations of the deadlines contained within the Coastal Act, the Coastal Act has a 49-day deadline for these appellate decisions from local government-approved permits to the commission. And the courts and the commission have interpreted that to mean 49 days to open the process. And once the commission opens the process, there is no deadline for them to close that process by actually making a final decision. So the commission will take a permit approval that oftentimes already represented 3 to 5 years of work between a developer and the county. The commission finds a substantial issue with it, which vacates that permit approval. And then the commission moves into a de novo permit process whereby they can really demand almost anything of the developer, and the developer has no mechanism by which to force that development forward or that process forward. So unlike many of the streamlining laws that otherwise exist for development in California, none of those apply to the Coastal Commission itself, and they can drag that process out for a very long time. And in our research, what we found is that even for a permit denial, where the commission simply decides they're going to take over the permit and then remove it entirely and essentially send the person back to start over, that takes about a year on average. And permit approvals take far longer than that, about 530 days to get to an approval, often with substantial modifications to the original project plan, and oftentimes with concessions or other mitigations attached to that permit, which again increases the cost of the finished product.
Very interesting. And so as I'm hearing it, really this, the California Coastal Commission, once the local land use folks come in on the first part of your answer there, was meant to have more of a ratification role than an independent reviewer role. And they've just sort of done a power grab that circumvents the original deal. Is that right?
That's correct. Essentially, again, our view of the Coastal Act is that that appellate power was limited to ensuring that you don't have bad actor local governments essentially taking advantage of this certification process, reobtaining local control, and then ignoring entirely those regulations. So the appellate power of the commission is limited to certain categories of development. So one area of their jurisdictional expansion has been creative interpretations of that list, that limited list. There are some areas where that's very straightforward. For example, development between the first public road and the sea is always subject to commission appellate jurisdiction. Occasionally, there's some factual disputes about whether or not a property falls within that boundary, but those tend to be minimal. One example I'll put forward of the kind of creative interpretation jurisdictional overreach, where the commission authorizes the Coastal Act authorizes commission jurisdiction over development that is not the principal permitted use within a zoning category of the LCP. And for decades, the commission and all local governments treated that as any principal permitted use. And about a decade or so ago, the commission said, wait a minute, the Coastal Act says the principal permitted use. We believe this means that the Coastal Act intended every coastal jurisdiction to have one single principal permitted use within each zoning area. And if they have more than one principal permitted use, that means we have appellate jurisdiction over every permit issued in that area. And in practical terms, for most counties within California, that has now opened up every single local government approved permit to commission jurisdiction. I think it's unlikely that's what the legislator intended. It may have been inartful drafting, but nonetheless, that's just one interpretation that the commission has pushed forward to grab jurisdiction over permits that previously would have been considered outside of their purview.
And we see this kind of model even in on the federal state level and federalism and sort of delegated state programs under the Clean Water Act and other things, in which it was intended to devolve authority down to those communities most directly affected, so that the federal government, for example, can have basic general standards for the Clean Water Act, but then the states have delegated authority to have their authorized state programs to actually do the minutia and the actual regulatory and the permit approvals and other things. And only when they really run astray is EPA supposed to come in and take take over that program. Very similar, I think, to what we're seeing here. And so I promise all of the listeners that we want to get to the fires and the current state of things quickly. But just a quick, I'd appreciate your thoughts because you are a local land use attorney and property rights attorney. Part of, can you tell us a little bit about why they wanted to give the authority to the local governments to ultimately decide this? Why do we devolve that kind of decision making down to local governments rather than powerful state apparatus?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, the California coastline, we're talking about over 800 miles of coast. These are unique areas, stretching from Oregon down to Mexico. There's quite a bit of variation in the type of coastal environment, in the type of community, that communities that exist along that coastline, in the type of development that already exists, the type of practices and development that and uses that people would like to see going forward. And I think the Coastal Act had a very strong recognition that these types of unique local challenges require individualized solutions, usually reached by the local government. And so while I think it's clear that the Coastal Act was intended to be one push of state policy or one way to ensure that state environmental policy was asserted and pushed down onto these local jurisdictions, as you mentioned, I think the more individualized and particularized determinations were meant to be left to those local governments. And again, the commission was given a very strong oversight role in that certification process, whereby a local government cannot enact new LCPs or amendments without going to the commission, submitting them, and allowing the commission the opportunity to certify. And it is effectively a veto power. If they disagree with the language put forward, they can reject entirely those amendments, or they can suggest modifications. But what the legislature did not do is give the commission any legislative power directly. So really their role was meant to be this certification process, this oversight process. And I think once those laws were certified, it was intended to provide quite a bit of power to the local governments. And again, give the commission just this oversight role to ensure that those laws were not ignored.
So it sounds like there's sort of two categories of potential reform or more, obviously. One is a legislative fix to reassert their own authority and to restate what those goals were or to take back, some of that power. And then second is, the courts through deferential standards have been largely complicit or enabling of the CCC's power grabs in these areas. I guess the question is, what can be done about this? What is being done? And in particular, did you see any movement prior to the most recent fires in California and legislatively or judicially or in the regulatory agencies? And what has happened since? So what's, now we can get to what's happening right now. Is there a renewed momentum or opening of the eyes on the part of those who may have been advocates for these strong regulatory structures to reexamine seeing some of the errors of the ways?
I think the short answer is yes. There is some hope in California. Even in California, there is some hope where in recent years, so I'll start a little bit from the beginning here. Pro-housing, I would say, or streamlining laws that have been passed in California over recent years. And these have been passed with the recognition that California has a severe housing crisis and shortage, that we have not been building enough to meet demand. For years, those laws always contained provisions exempting the coastal zone or the Coastal Act, or saying that nothing within those laws was meant to diminish the Coastal Act in any way. And really only in the last couple of years, we've seen some of the more pro-housing legislators within California include provisions that in fact apply those pro-housing laws even within the coastal zone. And so I think there has been some recognition that if we are going to build enough units, we are going to have to build them in the area where people most desire to build. And that is the coastal zone. So we have seen some push within the legislatively within California to at least chip away slightly from the scope and authority of the Coastal Commission and the Coastal Act. As far as judicially, as you mentioned, for decades, most of the opinions that we've seen have been extremely deferential to commission authority, very minimal scrutiny of commission interpretations or deference to commission interpretations. But in recent years, we've seen some inroads within the California courts. And the biggest example of that ongoing right now, one of our cases at PLF, Shear Development against California Coastal Commission, was granted review at the California Supreme Court. And we've just completed briefing in that case. And that did involve an issue where the local government issued a permit, said it was agreed with all of the local land use laws. It was consistent with all of the regulations. And importantly, the local government said that it was not an appealable permit to the Coastal Commission. And the commission nonetheless took appeal, and they asserted multiple areas of authority, one of which was the principal permitted use issue that I mentioned earlier. And the other was a fairly creative reinterpretation of the LCP that required the commission to ignore the kind of plain language of the LCP, which said the appealable zones are contained in official maps, and instead finding a figure elsewhere within the LCP that covered the subject property and saying any reference to this property within the LCP is enough to give us a jurisdictional hook. We believe that because we can pinpoint this property on a map that says there may be some dune sands underlying it that are sensitive habitat, we're going to assert that that is sufficient to give us a jurisdictional hook, despite, again, contrary language within the LCP, which said these are informational maps, the official maps are over here, and all of your appellate jurisdiction is governed by the official maps. And surprisingly, the Court of Appeal accepted that argument and essentially did an extremely deferential review of this core legal question of how is an LCP interpreted. And really, that's one of the core functions of the courts, is to interpret these laws and determine what the law says. That goes back to some of our very earliest cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. Marbury v. Madison is the province of the court to say what the law is. And here, the Court of Appeal really did not do that. The California Supreme Court granted review. We believe this is a sign that even the California Supreme Court is at the very least aware that the lower courts have been very deferential, and that there has been some division within those lower courts of exactly how deferential they should be. And we're hopeful that it's an opportunity for the court to kind of reassert its area of authority in these matters and be the primary interpreter of these land use laws, which will provide, I believe, more stability for local governments and landowners if these laws are treated objectively rather than kind of subject to the whims of commission reinterpretation.
So there are a couple other cases out there right now that are important developments to you, right? Hadean and Casamira. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yes, both of those, again, very recent cases. Hadean, the last day of last year, the opinion came down from the Superior Court. And that was, again, a jurisdictional issue where we argued that the commission had essentially no authority to take this permit over, that the language of the LCP was clear, and that they lacked essentially this jurisdictional hook. And in that case, we actually had a victory at the Superior Court. And it was really precisely the opposite example as the Court of Appeal, where a judge did a very in-depth analysis of the multiple provisions that were at issue and how they interacted. And by doing this holistic interpretation, was able to determine that the LCP precluded the commission from taking jurisdiction. So we're very happy with a win. I would love to see more judges following this example where they again, give a very critical eye towards these very fundamental jurisdictional questions of when the commission may take over and reject a permit approval from the local government. And the other one, Casamira, this is a case that was also a Court of Appeal case. This involves a separate provision of the Coastal Act and another example of this commission interpretive overreach, where the Coastal Act contains a provision that actually requires local governments and the commission to issue permits for shoreline protective devices. So things like seawalls, riprap, other measures to protect a collapsing bluff face where it might be in danger to an existing structure. And for decades, the first 40 years of the Coastal Act, everyone understood that existing structures meant existing at the time of the application for a seawall. So if you had lawfully constructed a home on this bluff face and a change in the environmental circumstances, a heavy El Nino year or sea level rise, if any of these measures threatened then your home, you were entitled to get this shoreline protective device to protect your private property and that investment. And starting about 2010, the commission suddenly reversed course and said, we believe existing structures actually meant existing as of January 1st, 1977, or the date that the Coastal Act went into effect. And, you know, it's surprising to me to think that the legislature would have done something so significant, such as banning all seawalls going forward with virtually no debate or discussion publicly. It's even more surprising to me to think that everyone involved would have immediately interpreted that provision incorrectly and consistently over the next 40 years. But nonetheless, the Court of Appeal accepted that interpretation, and that case is now being petitioned to the California Supreme Court. So I'm hopeful that is a case where we may get review at the California Supreme Court. If not, that's certainly another opportunity for legislative fix, because I think again, when individuals, I should add, the Coastal Act also contains a provision that says new development should be designed to minimize any need to rely on shoreline protective devices. So there are other measures within the Coastal Act that certainly disincentivize the need for these types of seawalls. But when someone has lawfully developed their property, obtained all the necessary permits, done all the studies, and everyone has done their best to avoid the need for a seawall, if in fact that is nonetheless required to protect an investment, I think the Coastal Act recognizes that to deny that would potentially be a taking of private property. So again, something that I'm hopeful will either be addressed in the courts or legislatively.
So with the Palisades Fire and other fires and other natural catastrophes in California, there's a real understanding of a need to redevelop and redevelop fast in the areas where that have been most affected. People need to move back into their homes. Economies need to be revitalized. So businesses need to be able to come back into the spaces. This has led to some very interesting maybe policy reversals, shifts, interesting coalitions being developed to either suspend or create exceptions or variances to some of the regulatory laws inside California. Can you tell us a little bit about the political shifts and or the political attempts to suspend or create exceptions to the regulatory structure, which seems to me to be an admission of the real impediments that these structures place on redevelopment?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it takes a catastrophe of this magnitude to shine a light on these issues, but you know, many people may have, for the first time, heard about the Coastal Commission, certainly outside of California. Many people for the first time may have been made aware of it by a rant by Adam Carolla that took place just days after the destruction of the fire. And the main thrust of that discussion was people are going to find out when they try to rebuild, when we have 10,000 homes along the coast that need to be rebuilding, and they try to go find a, you know, try to go seek a permit for this, they're going to discover just how onerous it is to obtain a permit to develop along the coast. And I think, certainly if everything had remained status quo, I can't imagine that even a fraction of those homes could have been rebuilt in the short term. And certainly, you know, it's not to say that it won't take some time for areas that are this destroyed to rebuild. But under the regulatory framework as it existed, I think decades would be optimistic. And so, again, just days after all of this took place, Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order which suspended the operation of the Coastal Act and the California Environmental Quality Act in areas impacted by the fire with respect to any homes that needed to be rebuilt. And so I think that is a tacit admission by the governor that if these regulations are not suspended, we simply will not be able to rebuild, and certainly not in the timeline that people would expect. I think most people expect that if your home is destroyed, you really have a right to replace what's been lost. And that's most people would have assumed that that's the status quo. And indeed, the Coastal Act does contain a provision that allows for a right to rebuild when homes are destroyed, but that hasn't stopped the commission in the past. And we have seen individuals be delayed or denied permits, even where it involved the rebuilding of homes. And so I think it was a very tacit recognition of the overreach of the commission that Governor Newsom stepped in and by executive order suspended those regulations. And perhaps even more surprisingly, despite that executive order, the commission nonetheless engaged in some various guidance, written or oral guidance, as to when and where you actually qualified as exempt for these rebuilding projects. And so about a week or so later, we were treated to a second executive order by Gavin Newsom, which said, no, really, I mean it, Commission. In fact, you're not only prohibited from acting under the Coastal Act or CEQA, you're also prohibited from even offering written or oral guidance as to the scope of the exemption I am putting forward. So really, a clear act and intent by the governor to shut down entirely the operation of the Coastal Act in these fire-ravaged areas so that they can, in fact, rebuild.
I think that's a very telling study, too, in what a lot of academics examine in terms of agency behavior and the way bureaucracies operate to self-perpetuate, and that threats to their existence are faced with claims of power that need to be doubly rebuffed, like the governor had to in this case. One curious aspect of this all is that the fires themselves may have been exacerbated, or the impacts may have been exacerbated by the existence of the regulatory structure. One way to think about this is that they could have perhaps made the fires worse as a result of the existing environment that was created by the lack of development and the lack of land stewardship activities that might otherwise occur that could contain or at least limit the spread of fire. And then, you know, a second claim I think can be made that environmental resources were more susceptible to destruction from any fires that actually occurred. In other words, you know, because you were unable to responsibly develop and maintain and be good stewards of certain areas meant that you might be more fire susceptible. That, in fact, leads to this unintended consequence of making entire habitats, for example, subject to destruction by fires in order to put someone through the ringers of a long-term development process. So I was wondering if you could comment on those two points. First off, you know, is there an argument that the regulatory structure actually made the fires impact worse? worse? And then second, is this, you know, part of that concern is, have the fires actually done significant environmental damage that could have been avoided had we had a more, reasonable understanding of how development works in conjunction with good land stewardship?
I think, the answer to both is yes. I think there's certainly at minimum, colorable arguments as to both. And I think one way in which the implementation of the Coastal Act and relevant to some of these new ongoing cases is that the inability for individuals to develop and redevelop in these areas has forced many of these areas to essentially be locked in time. And so, there's certainly anecdotal stories that can be found of individuals buying a property, perhaps one with a small home, and thinking, and we're talking about individuals with substantial means, and thinking, I'll be able to buy this Malibu property and maybe tear down a small, relatively dilapidated and wood structure built in the 1950s and replace it with a new modern, beautiful home, perhaps even a mansion. And the regulatory environment is so difficult for that redevelopment that it's simply not taking place. And so, in other words, a lot of these homes are probably, or these properties are probably not being put to their highest and best use or in a way in which, might be the most desirable and probably the best able to withstand these types of disasters. So I think certainly if the natural process of redevelopment and upgrading of these areas as they became so desirable was able to take place, I think we might have seen far more of these properties redeveloped with modern techniques, with modern materials, with perhaps a better planning that took into account these types of risks. And I think certainly that might have at least minimized the total amount of destruction. Because again, when you have an entire neighborhood of 70, 80 year old wood homes, a lot of them were virtually a tinderbox and able to go up and burn quite quickly. And I think as to the seawall issue, again, under this new interpretation of the Coastal Act, if you do redevelop your house, it is treated as new development. So an existing structure, if you wanted to pull down some of the walls and expand and you redevelop it more than 50%, the commission treats that as new development. Well, if you're new development, you're no longer an existing structure as of January 1st, 1977. And now you lose a very valuable right under the Coastal Act to protect your private property. So another disincentive to the type of redevelopment and improvement of these properties that might have, again, incentivized the creation of more fire-resistant homes. So I think there's certainly an argument there that it would be preferable to allow that type of redevelopment to take place rather than to make it so difficult and to discourage all of this type of creative destruction that normally would take place. As to the management, I think many individuals in the coastal zone have found themselves really caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they're required to engage in fire mitigation, brush clearing, things of that nature that are intended to ensure that these types of fires don't grow and tear through neighborhoods in the fashion that they did. On the other hand, CEQA and the Coastal Act, these environmental protective regulations, also include penalty powers. And the commission has been very aggressive with their penalty power. I should also note that they consider virtually anything development. So the definition of development under the Coastal Act has been treated so broadly that certainly clearing of brush, anything that changes the natural landscape whatsoever would likely require a coastal development permit. Again, there may be exemptions for fire mitigation techniques, but your average individual can't always understand what can I clear, what can I not clear, what methods of clearing are going to allow me to remove some of this dry brush without accidentally grading or disturbing habitat that might then lead to an enforcement action. So I think the aggressive enforcement of both the definition of development, which in California, in the California courts and in the view of the commission, a fireworks show is development. So opening a gate or closing a gate, that can be considered development. So for all of these relatively minor activities, you might either have to first go to the commission for an expensive permit or face the realistic probability of being fined over $11,000 a day for undertaking that activity without first seeking the permit. So I think it's been a tremendous disincentive to behavior that we really would much rather incentivize these individuals clearing their own property and ensuring that there isn't this dry brush that allows these fires to really just tear through entire areas.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, people are going to be rational and react to the regulatory system. And so, develop right up to that line instead of developing in a prudent way so that they don't get caught into the system. And then, of course, as you mentioned, individual property owners, they can't afford to hire an attorney and other things in advance of doing some of these activities. So they're going to assume, the risk of being wrong is really high because those penalties are too high. So it undoubtedly leads to over committed resources beyond what you would even need to, simply because people fear what the consequences would be of not going through those permit processes. Very interesting. I want to come back to one thing that you mentioned at the beginning, and just on housing. I think that there, I thought you could just say a couple things briefly about the unintended consequences on the housing market. You mentioned that before, but I want to stress one other thing. Part of it is that it takes a long time for something new to be built, and something is built at a much higher cost. And that is undoubtedly a reason why there's just simply not development, or not development at a pace we might otherwise wish. But when there's not development, it also affects the overall shortage issue in the market. That is that the cost of housing goes up just by the costs that are tied into the development itself, makes the product more expensive. But in addition to that, the costs and delays mean that less product is coming into the market. And when you have less product coming into the market, then you have a supply shortage in relation to the demand. And we know that a supply shortage in relation to demand drives up prices. So the driving up prices crowds even more people out. So it's kind of a double effect that's happening on the housing shortage as a result of a regulatory structure. It's not just about, oh, my home's more expensive. It's that my home's more expensive. It doesn't come online very quickly, but it also contributes to the overall shortage of housing supply. Any thoughts on that additional point?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I would, virtually all prices at the end of the day are going to come down to supply and demand. And there's high demand for homes in California. As you've mentioned, we already have a shortage. And on top of that, people are moving in. And simply to meet the growth in California, we need to add about 210,000 homes each year. And California has averaged roughly half that in good years over the last decade or so. So if we are ever, let alone reducing the existing price, if it's not going to continue to rise, we need to at least meet the growth in California. If we actually want to start driving down prices, we have to build more homes, and we have to build more homes of all types, because as you've mentioned, the increased supply at all levels will filter down. Even if you build a very expensive home, that opens up a less expensive home for the person who's now been able to build their perhaps dream mansion on the California coast. They move out of where they were living. A person in an apartment moves up to the home that's been vacated, and so on and so on. And things filter down to where eventually you're You're adding more affordable units, even if they're existing, simply by allowing development to take place. And that's something that with the focus on affordable housing, there's been too much emphasis on generating new low-priced units and not on simply increasing the supply across the board. Again, the most surefire economics 101 way to lower the prices would be to do that. But in California, it's simply been extremely difficult to do so. And again, I think it's also just worth mentioning that it's simply not a problem that California can spend their way out of. So in order to provide rental assistance, et cetera, for the number of people who are currently paying more than 50% of their monthly income, it would take about $10 billion a year in California to do that. So this is not simply a problem that we can solve with spending. We really do need to revisit the regulatory environment and say, why is it so difficult to build in California? Why is it so expensive? And if we do want these increased numbers of homes available, what can we do? What can we do that? And I think this fire really offers a very good inflection point for a reimagining or a revisiting of the utility of all of these regulatory frameworks that exist in California. If it is good to suspend these regulations temporarily for individuals who have been seen their homes destroyed and need to quickly rebuild, why are all of these regulations left in place for the thousands and thousands of landowners with empty units that could be put to a beneficial use? And in California, it's not just building out. That includes building in. There are too many units within existing neighborhoods that are right now being left idle because the regulatory prospects of navigating the hurdles to obtain a development permit are simply too difficult. And I think if we take an honest look at just how difficult it has been in California and continues to be, and perhaps if we also see the outcomes of this temporary suspension, it will force some legislative revisiting of the utility of these laws and whether or not some reform might be in order.
I think that's a great way to summarize the state of affairs and to sum up. So thank you very much, Jeremy Talcott of the Pacific Legal Foundation, for joining us on this podcast to reflect on important issues on the regulatory structure inside California, and really a discussion that bleeds over to the examination of the regulatory structures throughout the other states and at the federal level as well. Thank you so much to the Regulatory Transparency Project for hosting this, and I hope that the listeners have enjoy the program and we'll walk away with some useful tips.
Thank you. And thank you both for sharing your time and expertise with us today. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.